On This Week in Enterprise Tech, are you okay with broadcasters turning on your TV remotely? The Internet of Home Intrusion Things, net neutrality has got Chebert and I ranting once again, and Mark Balkanende from Talend is here to talk about data management and analytics. But it ain't no big data. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 266, recorded November 17, 2017. Talend evolves data analytics. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so that you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I need my friends. And this week, my friend is Jess Brian Chi. That's right, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Chebert, I heard you started a fire and destroyed all the fiber going to the islands.
Yeah, very sad. Apparently, a homeless encampment got cold and started a bonfire and managed to cook the primary fiber optic cable landing bundle that goes under the highway. And T-Mobile went dark. Oceanic Roadrunner went dark. And everybody else is now scrambling like crazy to reroute through the secondary or tertiary fiber links. Fun and games.
You know, it's kind of scary that this happens more often than you might think. I remember in Vietnam, they had a big cut because fishermen were just dragging up the fiber, thinking that it was copper that they could sell. So, hey, I mean, at least people got warmed up by this internet disaster.
Is it fair to say that? Second time, same place.
You know, I'm just going to throw this out there, but maybe they should move that.
Actually, I think they should just, you know, since it only comes up in one place, they should go just build a hollow tile building around it so that it doesn't happen again. Because this time it's really bad. It's going to be millions of dollars to fix.
Well, that's all on you, Chebert. So I hope you can get that fixed before you go away on vacation next month. By the way, Lumaresca is not with us this week because he is currently searching for the Holy Grail. We hope that he'll be back with tales of his exploits. But let's go ahead and jump straight into our episode. We've got a good one today. If you've ever wanted to know a little bit more about data management, we've got a guest in studio who's going to do just that. But first, as we always do, let's kick it off with the blips. Now, yesterday, by a vote of 3-2 along party lines, the FCC voted to approve the ATSC 3.0 over-the-air broadcast standard. The new standard uses orthogonal frequency division multiplexing and a 6 megahertz physical layer to deliver a variable bitrate between 1 and 57 megabits per second. This higher bitrate will allow for 4K UHD as well as HDR high frame rate and wide color gamut content to be delivered within one of three video formats, legacy SD, interlaced HD, and progressive. As the new standard uses internet protocol-based transmission rather than the traditional stream-based broadcast to provide interactive and multicast capabilities, ATSC essentially treats your TV as a browser, allowing the sharing of bandwidth and spectrum behind the scenes depending on the needs of you, the client. While the specs of ATSC 3.0 are promising, it's some of its features and what they mean for the public that had two of the FCC commissioners voting against the rollout. Specifically, ATSC 3.0 isn't backwards compatible, which means your current TV won't work without some sort of converter that may or may not actually exist. Broadcasters are asked to voluntarily provide dual broadcast to support ATSC 3.0 and ATSC 1.0 at the same time, but that agreement will only last 5 years. Also, the interactivity of the TV sounds like a good idea until you dig into the value adds that it will make possible. The system, discovery, and signaling will allow broadcasters to pinpoint your location and target specific ads to you. Also, the standard allows for TVs that are off to be turned on remotely. I don't see any possible use of abuse there. South Korea has already deployed ATSC 3.0, and they plan to broadcast the 2018 Olympics over their new standard. So this might be a good time to watch their market to see potential trouble down the road and to ensure that the FCC does what it needs to do to keep broadcasters from turning the rollout into a consumer-unfriendly cash grab.
Well, Qualcomm just rejected the Broadcom $105 billion takeover offer. Last week, Broadcom made an unsolicited offer to buy Qualcomm, one of the biggest SoC and cellular modem manufacturers for smartphones. Qualcomm officially rejected the initial bid yesterday, which was for $105 billion. It was originally reported to be around $130 billion. When reports first surfaced about the offer, it was known that Qualcomm wasn't happy with the deal. In a statement released yesterday, Qualcomm's board said the offer significantly undervalues the company. The bottom line is this takeover would have let Broadcom control the vast majority of wired and wireless network interfaces, and while not a monopoly, it would have certainly changed the industry. This undervalued, unsolicited offer does not close the door on the takeover, but it's unknown if Broadcom will return with a higher offer in the future.
A few weeks ago, Amazon launched its Key and Cloud offering, a $250 system that combined an internet-enabled security camera, a smart lock, and a service that allows for remote unlocking of your front door so that your Amazon purchases can be delivered into your home instead of the porch. An interesting idea that would have done away with the multi-million dollars of theft every year off the porch problem that the services like Amazon have encountered. But beyond the head-scratcher of allowing a complete rando into your home while you were away, the concept had a lot of IT folk wondering who exactly would trust a series of wireless IoT devices to control both security and entry to your home. Well, the systems are now in the wild, and it seems that those concerns were very warranted. Within just a few hours of hands-on time, security researchers and script kiddie amateurs have come to a very predictable conclusion, which is a wireless camera is a horrible choice for real-time monitoring of a remote entry system. Specifically, running an off-the-shelf DAuth attack against the camera knocks it off the network. And since video streams are stored in the cloud and not on the camera, you lose any visibility as long as the DAuth attack continues. Practical application, you watch a delivery man show up to your front door. He identifies himself. You remotely unlock the door, then your video stream freezes. It comes back a few seconds later as the delivery man is closing and relocking your door, but you have no idea what happened in the intervening seconds. Hey, back to the drawing board.
MariaDB is coming to Azure as Microsoft joins the MariaDB Foundation. Once known as MySQL, MariaDB is a fork from the original project of the open source SQL Server that has been the open source database of choice for a massive number of systems developers over the years. With it even showing up on NAS units from QNAP and Synology, MariaDB containers are showing up everywhere. So MariaDB is a fork of the original MySQL database that's developed and maintained by many of the original MySQL contributors. In 2008, Sun Microsystems bought MySQL AB, the company that developed and created MySQL. In 2009, Oracle announced its plans to buy Sun, creating fear in the community about MySQL's future as a successful community-developed open-source project. To ensure that the database would continue development in spite of the purchase, the MariaDB fork was created in 2009. The subsequent development of MySQL arguably justifies those fears. While Oracle still publishes source code, the development itself happens behind closed doors with minimal outside contributions. Well, this just means that Azure has yet another really great choice for a database that I, for one, applaud.
Now, Cray, the pioneer in supercomputing, has announced their Cray XC50 supercomputer series that will be powering the computational needs of big hitters such as the U.S. Department of Energy and the Coalition of Research-Intensive UK Universities, known as the GW4 Alliance. Available in both liquid and air-cooled cabinets, the XC50 can mix and match different blades housing Intel Xeon, Intel Phi, and NVIDIA Tesla GPU parts, depending on the type of computing required. However, one of the more interesting footnotes is what Cray did for their ARM-based blades. Instead of going with one of the giant ARM chip manufacturers, Cray chose San Jose-based Cavium as their supplier. Cavium, which is best known for the processor inside of SonicWall's high-end security solutions, will be supplying the 64-bit ARM V8A chip called the Cavium Thunder X2. Gray went with them on a performance basis, even as Qualcomm introduced their next-gen ARM-based Centrique processor. Score one for the little guy, and one for Grandpa Cray.
Woohoo! Pan for pwns with bug bounties to help cast a better light on its ranks. Bug Crowd yesterday released numbers detailing the demographics of its 65,000-strong crowd. That release is buttressed by a survey of 500 sample members that offers some insight into who exactly signs up to participate in the public and private bug bounty programs run by the company. And the sketch, The Mind of a Hacker 2.0 report, provides of the vulnerability hunting community is one you might have pieced together on your own if you spent any time at a security conference lately. Increasingly experienced and professional, diverse, at least from a national origin standpoint, highly educated, and mostly under 30. White hats, celebrate. Panning for Pwn Gold is cool, and the once exclusive club seems to be where the elite are taking their talents.
Now, last week, we covered the legal victories of Colorado citizens over various ISPs, with more than 20 cities in Colorado voting to overturn ISP-sponsored legislation that kept them from building out municipal networks. Now, that was a top-down approach in which politically motivated citizens organized to remove restrictions that ISPs have used to squeeze ever more revenue out of their customers. But those 20 cities are just a fraction of the more than 200 across the country that are in the various stages of building their own networks. And not all of them are top-down. For example, Detroit. In a city in which 40% of the population has no access to any communications, not just broadband, and 70% of school children can't access the internet from home, the problem isn't so much that ISPs are restricting build-out as that they've long abandoned cities like Detroit that have no hope of turning a profit. For communities like Detroit, a municipal network isn't a way to force competition into markets that aren't being properly served by ISPs, who have been allowed to shirk their responsibilities as set forth by the 1986 Cable Communications Act, but rather the only way that they'll be able to bridge an ever-growing digital divide. And Detroit, against all odds, is doing just that. A coalition of community members and Detroit-area nonprofits have been lighting up dark fiber abandoned by several large telcos and installing wireless base stations in the tallest buildings in the least served areas. Those residents who can't afford the internet, those on basic assistance, and students have been prioritized in the first few deployments. And this isn't a parachute project where outsiders install gear that is then left to break in the coming years. The program has been running 20-week-long courses to train community members in the design, deployment, and maintenance of these systems with an eye on sustainability. Furthermore, the project has started to develop their own library of knowledge and tools on a community intranet. Just as Colorado is a shining example of communities standing up to ISP greed through legislation, perhaps Detroit can be an example of communities standing up to neglect. Top down or bottom up, it's time to help communities reclaim their rights to communicate. That does it for the blips. Next up, we've got the bites. But first, let's take a break to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, the last time you went in for a mortgage, it was fun. Right? I mean, we all enjoy having to find those old receipts and pay stubs. We all like going to a bank and talking to some complete stranger who then has the power to decide whether or not you are a good investment. That's fun. That's enjoyable. That's something that we all have on our pleasure list, right? No, of course it's not. It's horrible. And it's not just that it's a long, monotonous project. It's that, well, the mortgage process hasn't kept up. And that's why we're so happy to have Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans as a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now, Rocket Mortgage understood that the mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated. It needed a client-focused technological revolution. That is Rocket Mortgage. Now, Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Now, it's simple. It allows you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. Forget those banker's boxes. Forget those old pay stubs. Forget those faded receipts. You just click and you're good to go. It's also powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in just seconds. And then with those calculations, based on your income, assets, and credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's just right for you. It's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's jump into something that, I think it's going to be non-controversial, nothing that Chibert and I have a particular stake in, nothing that we've spent a lot of blood, sweat, and tears on. Super simple topic, net neutrality. Yeah, it's our favorite. It's back. I know we've tried to delay it. We've pushed it back. We've pushed it back. We know we covered a lot, but it's back in the news because, folks, it's about to die. That's right. According to sources, in December, the start of December, the FCC is ready to nix net neutrality in its entirety. Now, we understand that over the last couple of months, they've set the ground for this. This is not a surprise. They've already gone through the reclassification of ISPs from utilities back to services, which basically means the FCC can no longer regulate them the way that they were supposed to. And we know that FCC Chairman Ajit Pai has long been a detractor of anything called remotely anything like net neutrality. He is a big proponent of the market will provide. He is a big proponent of competition will solve. And it doesn't matter how many people come forth and tell him that there is no competition in the ISP market, there is no competition in the broadband market, he will not be swayed. Well, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai will unveil his final proposal next week. It sets up a vote at the commissioner's regularly scheduled monthly meeting on December 14th, according to both Bloomberg and Reuters. Now, the FCC hasn't publicly confirmed the December vote, probably because they weren't ready to handle the first or second or third backlash. But as Bloomberg and Reuters have reported, the timeline was confirmed by people familiar with Pai's plans. And it just makes sense. They want some sort of major victory before the end of the year. Now, we remember that net neutrality was starting to go down in flames as the FCC killed Title II. And not only did they kill Title II, but they did it in such a way that's going to make it difficult for that decision to be reversed in the future. Now, Pai was on the short end, back when he was not the FCC commissioner, of a 3-2 vote to reclassify broadband providers as common carriers back in 2015. So I think there's no mystery here, right, Chibert? I mean, when we look at this, this is where we were heading. People kind of wanted not to think about it, but ultimately, yeah, we're going to go back to pre-2013 FCC.
You know, my big comment is Ajit Pai the Grinch that's going to steal net neutrality out from under the consumer's Christmas tree? You know, that's kind of what it's coming down to. We're going to go back. We might as well be rolling the clock back, you know, 10, maybe even 15 years. And, you know, considering how much Congress is using net neutrality as examples, it really leads me to believe that maybe Mr. Pai isn't even listening to his overlords. I don't like this at all. But I saw it coming too. And I think they're doing it right now because, one, they want it before the end of the year. But I think they're also doing it because a lot of people aren't paying attention.
We've got Emily in the Emily the Strange in the chat room. Emily the Strange. Yes, actually, Emily is the Strange. But she brings up a very good point, and she wants to know about Title II. Does it mean it's dead for other things that use it, or is it only Title II for ISPs? Let's go a little bit back, because it's always good to take a refresher course in how we got to this point. You may remember that when we first had to go through this way, way, way back, this is before most of our audience was born, they had the ability to classify internet services as either a service or a utility. Now, if you are a utility, you run under different rules. Like, for example, if you are water, if you're power, a utility can't just keep jacking up their rates. It's not just the market will provide, because the government grants you some sort of functional monopoly in exchange for you supporting and looking after the benefits of the community at large. That's the deal. You get this wonderful right to roll out a service and basically be unchallenged, but in exchange, you have to be regulated. Well, the cable companies, according to the Cable Communication Act of 1986, they essentially took the same deal. It wasn't under the original Title II, but it was effectively the same as Title II. They said, we will accept these almost exclusive right of way so that we can lay down a network to serve cable communications in exchange for, and this is actually in the language of the 1986 bill, looking after the common good of the communities that we serve. The problem is that language was incredibly nebulous, and FCC commissioners all the way down the road, both Republican and Democrat, have basically allowed them to get away from that responsibility. They no longer hold them to the common good clause. Well, Title II, as the previous chairman tried to establish in the FCC, was a way to sort of call the ISPs back to that. They would say, look, you've been getting away with murder all these years. We want to make sure that you look after the common good as you said you would. Well, in the landmark Verizon versus the FCC case back in 2014 and 2013, Verizon won because the court said, well, you can't tell them what to do unless you hold them under Title II. However, the courts also said, as the FCC, you can reclassify them as a utility, which would then hold them under Title II. So that's exactly what Wheeler did. He reclassified them so that they were now utilities, which means the FCC now had the ability to regulate them and hold them to the agreements that they first made in the 1986 Cable Communications Act. What Chairman Pai is doing is he's removing that. And he's essentially saying this is not the FCC's business to regulate. In fact, he's saying it's the FTC's business to regulate ISPs. Of course, the FTC has even less manpower than the FCC, so there will be no regulation there ever unless they do a massive increase of budget and a very quick roll-up of human resources. So that's, in a nutshell, how we got here. What Title II was trying to do was to make the ISPs do what they promised to do. And now we have a chairman who is essentially saying, you know what, we're going to forget the fact that we gave these companies a functional monopoly. We're going to forget the fact that the American people have already put more than $200 billion into the telco industry in the form of tax loopholes and reductions. And instead, we're going to say, well, now the market will solve, even though this is clearly not a level playing field. Cheebert, that's about as much as I can do without going crazy ranty. Where are you on this?
Well, I'm actually going to go and try and answer Emily the Strange's question. So I'm doing a real fast lookup. Anyway, Title II may have been back in the 1930s when it was first passed. And her question is, why did AT&T get broken up for being a monopoly then? My personal opinion, this is my personal opinion, is that AT&T was, as a monopoly, really wasn't doing anything but the absolute barest minimum. So I actually lived, you know, obviously I lived through the breakup. And back in the day, I actually had sold leased line modems, but I actually had to be AT&T certified in order to hook them up. There was a lot of regulation, a lot of rules, not regulations, a lot of rules put on us by Ma Bell, and it strangled competition. Now, once the deregulation happened, all of a sudden, instead of having three or four modem manufacturers, all of a sudden we had hundreds. We had competition. We had amazing technical innovations. So Title II has been very, very unevenly enforced, very, very unevenly used, and it's all being driven by the FCC, mostly by the FCC chair. And this is why I'm kind of getting all hot under the collar, so to speak, that we're losing all this ground that Tom Wheeler gained for the consumer. Ajit Pai's, you know, actions are very clearly big business. They're very clearly pro ISPs. And, you know, just looking at that example we had about Detroit having to put in their own community network really and truly shows that something ain't working, and maybe I think we need a firmer hand, not a looser hand.
Yeah, we've got JJ to the 4884 and HiWeb in the chat room. They're both, and I get this, they're both saying, wait a minute, you know, maybe this is a forward-looking policy. Maybe this is something that he's hoping to institute as change into the future, and I 100% disagree with that. If you look at what he's trying to do with quote-unquote deregulating the market, this is going back to before the change. He wants to create Ma Bell. I mean, look at the FCC and what they're doing in other markets. They've now just removed all the rules that prevent the conglomeration of media companies, because we all know that when you have just one or two media companies, you get bad, bad, bad media. You get bad news. You get bad programming. Well, the FCC has basically said, no, hands off. You can do whatever you want. That's not good for the consumer. Look at the very first thing that Ajit Pai did when he became the chairman of the FCC. He removed the restriction that was placed on ISPs from selling your data. The ISPs were going to be held to the standard that they're not allowed to sell your private metadata without asking you first. He said, no, you can go ahead and sell whatever you want. How in the world is that friendly to consumers? How in the world is that friendly to competition when you have all that data concentrated in a handful of companies? So, I mean, when you look at what the policies of the FCC are doing, that this is what has me so puzzled. I understood Ajit Pai's background. I understood where he was coming from. I understood he's a laissez-faire market guy. But the policies that he's been enacting and the way that he's been running the FCC don't seem commensurate with those political leanings. I mean, just look at what happened with investment. The ISPs, when the net neutrality debate happened back in 2015 and when the policies first went into effect, they said, oh, this is going to kill investment. This is going to make it impossible for us to invest in infrastructure. You will never see new products and services from these telcos because they won't make money. Those years where we had the net neutrality regulations were the highest investment rates on history. The telcos put so much money into their networks because they realized, oh my goodness, if we don't increase the quality of our networks, if we don't increase the quality of our services, we won't compete. We go out of business. Now that it's being rolled back, look at the investment rate. It's dropped almost 70% in 2017. Why is that? Well, maybe because they realize that they're about to be granted the same monopoly that they had back when Ma Bell was still in operation. I mean, again, this is just a rant. This is just me. But if you look at it, it really does kind of make sense. Chibert, the question is, we've got at least another 2 years of this. What do you do? The FCC operates on its own. It's there. Those who are against the change are completely outnumbered here. Is there anything to slow this down or at least make it so that when we have another administration, we can reverse some of these things?
Realistically, the chat room's blowing up. You know, everybody's talking. Yeah. The only way we can really and truly stop this is for Congress to actually pass a law saying no, hands off. And I'm sure, you know, other than, you know, people like Al Franken trying to use net neutrality to handle things like Lifeline, the reality is we need to rise up. We need to call, write, email, telegram, whatever, our congressional delegations and say we are displeased. We need to make them know that they are going to get voted out of office if they don't do something about reining in Ajit Pai. Now, I don't know if it's going to work. You know, I agree with JJ. You know, Al Franken's kind of a, you know, whatevers. But the reality is we the people are supposed to be the government, not the guys in Washington, D.C. We the people. And if we the people don't call, if we the people don't email, if we the people don't make our voices heard, we the people become we the sheep. Sorry.
Well, good. I think we've solved it. That's the last time we're ever going to have to mention net neutrality, right, Jibert? Thank you,
picture.
Kevin. That's our TD. Always ready with the special effect and the graphic of Ajit Pai. We are going to have to come back to this. You know what? I don't want to talk about this while Chibert is away on vacation because I always enjoy a good Chibert rant. But so how about this? What if we hold off until the new year, Chibert? Can we come back to net neutrality then?
Yeah, obviously.
All right. Well, folks, let's move away for something that's such a wonderful, lovely conversation. So unconflicting as net neutrality. And instead, get to my favorite part of every show, and that's when we bring in a guest to dump some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And this week, our guest is in studio. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce to you Mr. Mark Balcanetti. That's right. He is from data integration solution provider. It's called Talend, right? I kept saying Talend D, but it's Talend.
No, it's Talend. Yeah.
Now, Mark, so tell me, what is Talend? If you were to describe Talend and the services that you provide to the man on the street, how would you do it?
Talend is a data management and data integration company. We specialize in really anything enterprises need to do with their data, whether it's moving it, managing it, governing it, mastering it. So, and whatever the integration pattern is that you have, your needs are, whether it's real time or batch, whether you're going in the cloud or you're using, and I hate using the word big data, but the right. big data technology. So Hadoop, Spark, you know, whatever, NoSQL. Those are all the platforms that talent plays in and that we specialize with.
Oh, this is a consultancy market that I have seen rise over the last, I'd say, 5 or 6 years. Because, yeah, there was the big push of big data. When big data was still a new thing, everyone's like, oh, yeah, I've got a lot of data. Where's my data? Let's put it together. Let's make it work. Let's make my data make money for me. And then they started to realize, okay, I understand the theory, but the practice is very different. When I have all this data, I actually need someone who understands the tools and understands what's possible to make from the tools to actually do something useful with the data. Is this an awareness that you have seen slowly creeping into the enterprise where they realize it's not enough just to buy a big data tool, but you actually have to understand and have people who understand how to use it?
Absolutely. And that's been the rise of what they call the data scientists now and the data engineers and the guys, the people that really know and can spend a lot of time on this data. You know, because before this movement, everybody, we all focused, and I was one of them, putting all the data into enterprise data warehouses, doing the third normal form and all those fun things that you like to do in your relational databases, and having very structured systems. So, you know, now it's putting or getting your hands on the raw data and understanding right. the raw data and seeing and being able to get faster value because you're no longer working with transformed data. You're working directly with the source data.
Let's talk about that raw data, because before you came to Talend, you had a very interesting history. You were with Motorola, you were with Abbott Labs, you were with Walgreens, and all three of those companies have very interesting but very different data sets that come in. Was there a common thread that you saw through those three companies that you think helps you when you envision what's possible to do with captured data?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, in those companies, in my experience, I was doing master data management. If you remember that, people still do that, by the way, and we help companies do that. But now, in these raw forms, you still have that problem, but it's bigger and it's harder to solve because you're dealing with sources that change constantly. So being able, look at those. You know, where I was at Abbott and Motorola and definitely Walgreens had a wide variety of data and challenges. I really could see, I can see how these new world of, data lakes, as they call them, where the raw data is stored.
It's strange how many different phrases we've gone through. Big data, data lakes, data forests. And it's like, I never know, okay, what's in right now? What should I call this?
Data lakes today.
It's data lakes. Okay, let's stay with data lakes. But let's consider that. Before we present the solution, because of course Talend is a company that presents solutions for data management, let's talk about the problems. Because unless we understand the problems, unless we can see how enterprise is going to run into those problems as they try to develop a data management strategy, it doesn't make sense to present the solution. In your experience, when you've got a customer or a potential client coming to you, what would you say are the three biggest mistakes they make with their data management?
First is just, listening to the marketing spiel.
That's true.
So a lot of people ran out and just threw up Hadoop clusters and because that's what, everybody was telling them to do.
They're not actually doing anything, but I've got
And they're like, Hadoop clusters. Okay, I got my Hadoop cluster up. I got 20 nodes. Now what do I do with it? Right. And how do I get my data in there was one big problem. So it's really, understanding, what are the things out there that you think you want to achieve? Because a lot of times you can't fully see the big picture until you start looking at the data, until those data engineers start mining through the data. And we used to call it data mining. Now we call it data science, but
data science sounds less, intrusive, I think.
Yeah, sexier. Yeah. So don't run off and pick a solution before you really know what the problem is. Understand, what are the key things that your industry really could benefit from. Don't do machine learning just because everybody's talking about machine learning or AI. look at what the problem is and what are the possible solutions, and that'll help you craft your architecture and what you want to go after.
That seems to be one of the increasing issues. When I go to Enterprise Connect or when I go over to Interop, again, it's so heavy on marketing speak, and you can't avoid that. That's how you get people interested. That's how you get them in to try your product. But I will run into people who say, well, we bought this solution and we think it's working. We're getting actionable information, but we don't actually have anything to compare it against. You know, this might be our first effort.
Right.
So what do you do for a client like that? Maybe a client who has some experience with data management, with data science, but isn't sure if they're actually using their data set and their tools to the fullest.
We have a lot of, so Talent has a lot of different partners that we work with to really help build that ROI case or show the insight. So a lot of our customers, they did run out and buy those clusters and were having a hard time getting the insights. But, we worked with a lot of different companies to use, different machine learning practices to see, learn how to do it. And we worked with Lenovo was one of our customers that they did that. They were just using some machine learning and trying to figure out how to get some insights. And they had to step back and say, hey, well, wait a minute, what do we really want to solve, or what's one of the things that we think we can do best with this technology? And now they're seeing a lot more customer value out of it. So,
okay, now let's actually bring it to the solution level, because I know just this last October, Talon released a brand new suite of data management tools. Can you tell me a little bit about that and what you find exciting about what your company's released?
Yeah, so the most recent release, we are starting to move more and more of our platform into the cloud. So where we host the data management solution. So we now have data integration where you can do data integration between applications and cloud applications in the cloud, where we host the platform. So you no longer have to go install servers and repositories. In the most recent release, we put data preparation into the cloud as well. So a new tool that we released about a year ago, but only on with the one that you had to install. Now you can have a fully hosted data preparation where you look at the data, cleanse it, change it, do certain things. We have some semantic analysis in the data, so it shows you what we think the data might be for you. So we put that all out there in the hosted environment now for our customers.
Let me go to a practical example. I always use this whenever I do a talk on big data. In my former office in DC was right next to the National Geographic office. And those were the years where National Geographic was sort of trying to reinvent themselves. They weren't making anything for the magazine anymore. They were kind of wondering if they were going to have to sell off the company. And then some bright person in the IT department said, wait a minute, we have literally hundreds of thousands of hours of footage sitting in our vaults doing nothing. And then they started cataloging it and they said, This is the only revenue stream we will ever need. It doesn't matter if we never take another video of the wild ever again. We can just license this and sell it. And it has completely changed the company. I mean, it's become a multi-billion dollar company again. They look flush for the future. I'm wondering, is there an analog to the big data side? Do you ever come into a client and say, do you have any idea how much data you've collected and what you can do with it? Because I know Talon D, one of your mottos is to find new revenue streams.
Absolutely.
So how do I do that? How do I bring you in and say, I've got a lot of data here. Is there any of it that might be useful for a new revenue stream?
Yeah, definitely. So, a good example of that is we have, a large pharma, which I can't mention the name of, but they wanted to start taking advantage of a lot of the historical studies, because in the past, and I come from Abbott, this isn't our customer, but that's why I come from that background. Mm-hmm. And, in the past, you could only do analysis on about 7% of the data because the systems weren't big enough and they would take weeks and weeks to run the different algorithms against the data to determine, are these good, possible drugs or molecules to turn into drugs? So we had a customer come to us and ask us how they could take these platforms and start running new algorithms against all the data rather than, say, 7% of it. And they've started going back through historical computations and historical data now that they actually can process it faster and starting to find new drug compounds that they missed or overlooked because of their old archaic processes. So
now, see, that That's unique. That's interesting because my audience has long understood that, yeah, you could look at old data points. So location, mm-hmm. identity, any little bits of metadata that you might contain for a particular record. This is the first time I've heard someone use data management in terms of previous calculations, old algorithms mm-hmm. that you've used. I mean, when you think about it, those took a lot of resources to develop. Yeah. It makes sense that you would very quickly compare them against a new batch of problems, a new batch of possible
Absolutely.
Revenue streams.
And then, like I said, they used to only look at about 7% of the essay study data, and now they can look at all the data and get much better results on, and they're reevaluating a lot of molecules and things.
I think this is important because we've got JJ to the 484 mm-hmm. in the chat room, who I think is making a very good point here. We get paranoid on this network, our audience, mm-hmm. anytime we have someone who talks about selling data, because they think, oh, well, that's invasion of privacy, right? That's right. My data that you're selling, which, of course, that is part of the equation. That, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not going to lie, but what you're pitching right now and what you're talking about and what makes this unique is this is not customer data. This is research data.
Right.
So right. But how do you do that? I mean, how do you go to an inventory of old research and effectively compare it against what it might be useful for?
So I mean, it's again, comes back to the newer platforms and being able to store the data. And this company used S3 to have all the data sit out in Amazon on S3. And we helped them, you know, learn how to use the EMR processing to start running some of the new, you know, taking new algorithms against the data. So they just had much more power than they did before. So we just helped, you know, show them. And they chose Amazon over the other ones. I mean, we try to stay neutral. We try to say Switzerland on the different cloud providers and different distros. But you know, once they've picked, then we help them figure out what's the best way to start processing this data quickly. So
before I get back to the chat room, would Talend allow me to move between different cloud providers?
Absolutely.
So you're not tied. You're completely agnostic. It's wherever you store your data, we'll help you manage it.
Yeah. Tuesday I did a webinar on Google, and then on Wednesday I did one on Microsoft Azure. So, and then of course we've supported Amazon stuff for years.
That's what I like to hear. But specs in the chat room also brings up another good question, which is how much confidence can you have in the old data? I mean, at some point you kind of need to look through your storehouse and say, some of this needs to be removed, or maybe some of it is no longer valid. Some of it's been disproven.
Mm-hmm.
That's definitely a problem. So is that part of the data management solution, or does that have to come up later?
I think if I remember correctly, they use like a second phase, but a lot of times, you know, it depends on how you develop your studies and how you develop the process itself. Because they took a lot of their, you know, all their data and put it in there. So it was available, which is often the case in these data lakes, but where it has all the data, it's just, you need to make sure that you incorporate that and make sure you architect the solution to use all that data correctly.
Right. There is a syndrome. I was at a Splunk conference not too long ago, and there's a syndrome that they like to call data drowning in a data lake.
Mm.
And the idea is, everyone loves the tools that they buy for big data. And if you've got it set up properly, the correlations that you can pull out, it's almost like childlike glee to see what comes back. However, there have been instances where enterprises have been paralyzed by the data because they've invested so much in the tools, and the tools may not be telling them what they want it to say, that it kills a decision that should be made. Do you plan for that? Do you offer consultancy for that? Because, I mean, every enterprise that ever uses big data is going to come to a point where the big data tells them to do the exact opposite of what all their strategists are telling them.
Yeah, we can definitely help out, help the companies with that as well, with a lot of the tools and some of the data preparation pieces as well, help show you different ways of looking at your data as well. So being able to see the different views and get the results really helps those people out with getting past that over analysis paralysis, as some people call it.
I like that. Although data drowning sounds better.
Yeah, it does. But
That
sounds
paralysis.
New. Analysis paralysis, the old what we used to call it when we couldn't get past it and make a decision on anything whatsoever. So.
Okay, before I bring Cheebert back into the conversation, I want to give you an opportunity to give me sort of, I know you can't mention names, that's part of the game, but give me an example of a company coming to you, our mythical 10,000-seat enterprise,
mm-hmm.
and says, this is the data we have. What do we do with it? So this is sort of a carte blanche. What would Talon be able to do? What would be the steps that you would take to make sure that I'm actually getting some return on this investment?
Mm-hmm. So we had one in the UK come to us. It's one of the largest home improvement companies in the UK that really did that with it and came to us. And they had a problem where they literally have people out in trucks looking or quoting customers on, you know, new bricks for their driveway or tiles, you know, and they wanted to find the exact picture. And they have this whole huge database already of every brick that they could purchase or make or whatever. And so they're using a combination of some machine learning as well as TensorFlow to actually identify the exact color and brick that's in their vast variety of things. So the guy that's out in the dump trucks and out and quoting things on the construction site is using his phone to take a picture, and it's sending it back to their environment using those machine learning and the TensorFlow to identify the closest. And almost every time they get a 100% match, it's amazing the stats that they're getting back from it. So they looked at all this data that they had and using some of those technologies to come back and give you some good results. So
Sorry, I just have to. I chuckled because our chat room has always, as always, what happens when we are talking about big data is wondering about you know, the NSA coming to Talon and saying, "Hey, we've got this building out in the middle of Nevada. We're wondering
not yet.
A bunch of data you could use."
No, not yet.
That's different.
No, not that I know of.
Right,
so
of course.
I haven't been involved in that.
Naturally,
so, luckily.
But see, that's the part of the process that fascinates me, because there does seem to be a little bit of a mini feedback loop, and I mean this in a good way, in the sense of if when a customer comes to you with a potential problem, that guides what data points you're going to pull out of their data lake,
mm-hmm.
and then that in turn will guide what sort of things they're going to do to correct the problem that put it in line with the data being
right.
analyzed. So what kind of time frame am I looking at? I mean, if again, let's use that same mm-hmm. mythical customer in the UK to get something that's useful. What kind of a deployment time am I looking at, and then what kind of a maintenance time am I looking at to make sure that I can change my business practices to more fully take advantage of that analysis?
So the nice thing about Talon is we sit on top of a lot of the Hadoop distros and allow you to work directly within the different platforms. So It makes it a lot easier and faster. We can install the agents needed to run on the master nodes very quickly. So we interact with Yarn so that you can run on Spark, for example, directly with Spark. And so that allows us to be much quicker. You don't have to go install stuff on all your nodes and worry about different programming languages and things like that. It works natively with this. So you could have, you know, we can typically, we can even show things within a proof of concept, the POCs, within a week or two of real value, as long as the environments are there and ready, you have the data, we can sit right on top of that process and jump in and start using our tools to help you understand it immediately.
I'm going to ask you about any nightmare data scenarios you might have walked into, because I can't think that there's never been a client coming to Talon D where they go, here's our big data, and you just sort of look at it and go, oh my gosh,
yes,
what a mess. But before we get to that, I do want to bring in my co-host, Chibert. You've got a specific use for any data management / big data / data lake / data forest tools in academia. What's unique about academia?
Well, our problem is we've got decades and decades of data. Literally, we don't have a data lake. We have a data ocean. And the problem with scientists is they're not very good at cross-pollination. You know, they will be collegial. They will share data. But there has been lots and lots of people talking about, well, we need to have it, you know, the geology, the geophysics, the oceanography, the physical, you know, all this kind of data that gives us descriptions, in our case, in the Pacific Basin. So with this data ocean that we've got, planning is a really, really, really big deal. You know, you have to ask the right questions. You have to have the background in order to do things.
Absolutely.
So here's the question. From a researcher standpoint, and also from a student standpoint that wants to get into this game, What kinds of things would you recommend for someone to be better prepared to be the so-called data lifeguard?
You know, I think it's, it comes back to a very similar thing as years ago when I, you know, it was only 5 years ago that I joined Talon, or 6 years ago, but while I was still in the industry myself, you know, it's understanding the end result before you get started. You know, so many people just, they see a new technology or they a new programming language. They, you know, something comes out that's flashy and they want to try it out. And they start applying it to your ocean of data. And before they realize, what am I trying to do, or what is the answer that we're trying to get to? And that's nothing new. That's something that you know, developers and engineers and data scientists, whatever you want to call them, it's always been a problem. You know, but the more successful ones are the ones that can look at what is this answer that I'm trying to get to? Where am I trying to go before you jump onto the solution and understand what that is? And then understanding the data as well. So, you know, the oceanographic data that you're talking about is going to be very different than a point of sale data or IoT sensor data with, you know, JSON formats coming in different, you know, different flavors. So, you know, understanding that and then combining the two together to get the right solution. And whether it's a Hadoop solution, whether it's a NoSQL database or graph database, document database, you know, you need to understand what the problem is, what the data looks like, and then what the end result should be to really come up with the best answer.
I'm going to piggyback on Chibert's question here, because academia and big data offers a very unique opportunity in that anything that's done by academia that's government sponsored should technically be available for the public. It should be available for everyone to analyze. But as Chibert has mentioned, a lot of times those scientists aren't good at sharing. They silo their own data. And their data isn't always in a format that really, you know, offers itself to be shared with a tool. If Talon D could go into one of the academic conferences and say, this is how you should format your data, this is what would make it most shareable, this is what would make it easiest to compare against other data sets for future analysis, what would be the ideal?
That's a good question. I haven't really thought about that. You know, it's because there's a lot of different places now that you can put your data open data source websites and things like that. So, I think starting there would be the best place to store. You know, put, as long as it's data that you can store, obviously, out in the public domain. But you know, and then putting it into, you know, a somewhat semi-structured format. So whether it's JSON or Avro or you know, using one of those formats would be, you know, most liked, because they're most easy to work with and deal with. And if it's a larger data set and you want to use compression on it, so you want to look at maybe, you know, the Avro or Parquet formats as well, depending on what kind of data you're dealing with. So
I just bring that up because we've got the future of data science in our audience. And, you know, they may not have access to data sets that are owned by large corporations. I mean, that's all proprietary data. They paid for it. They're going to keep it. But they should have access to research that's being done with their tax dollars, that's being done in their name. And, you know, I could see, just like in your example of going through all the old data and finding new solutions, it would be amazing if the future generation of data scientists had access to all the research that has been done in this country that's public. Because, I mean, all it takes is one or two innovative data scientists to take old data and turn it into something that is absolutely
amazing.
There was I can't remember who did it. There was a data scientist who did a talk, and her conclusion was, some of the answers to some of the most interesting problems we have are probably already there. We are constantly redoing experiments because we're not very good at seeing beyond our experiment. So that's why she was so excited about the future of data science, because it's not just my research. It's how my research can build on research from the last 300 years.
And I think on top of that, it's also the readily available access, not only to the data, but now to, you know, with Spark and machine learning, the Spark libraries for all the machine learning libraries that they have put out there, it's become even more readily accessible to the more average person. Before, you know, it was the guy in the basement that had the special tools and knew the algorithms and how to make it all work against the data. Now, you know, the average data person like myself can easily access this and start applying that to new data, you know, old data sets, new data sets, and start seeing, you know, trying different things that maybe the people before never did. So just like the pharma company going back and looking at all the test essays and things like that and rediscovering new possibilities with old molecules. So,
all right. We do have a little bit of time left, and I want to give it to you because I've enjoyed this conversation, but I want to make sure that you get out there what talent can do. You've already given us a semi white paper case. Is there another one that you can give us that can really drive home how a consultancy like yours can change a business entirely?
So a good one is Travis Perkins in the UK. Is another another construction company, right, that we work with, but they've taken their data set and with our help gone against a lot of their customer data and has reprocessed their customer interaction platform, they called it, that really drove more business for them by almost 300% by having discovering how customers interact with them in all the different touch points using the larger data set than before. So they're taking all the different channels, you call it, so whether it's the web or social media or call center information, and really tying that all together and being able to see better patterns and knew how to better interact with their customers from new and old. And it literally increased their profits and the revenue by 300%. So it was a huge success story for us.
Not bad. Yeah, 300%. I think I'll take that. Yeah. But for me, what fascinates me about the coming of data science is there's something for everyone in the C-suite. The CIO can look at this and say, I get great new tools and great new hardware for me to do something in my department. The CFO is going to look at this and say, oh, you're going to take something that we already have and you're going to reuse it. That's great. I love that. That's good financial policy. The CEO is going to say 300% increase. Yeah, I'll take that.
Yeah.
Easy sale. It really should be an easy sale.
A lot of times it can be. Yeah. Especially if you can prove that. So that sometimes is the hardest part though. So
Mark, I want to give you one last bit because we are out of time, unfortunately, but if you could offer a little bit of advice for any IT folk out there, be them the, you know, the IT grunt who is just making sure that the systems stay up all the way up to the CIO, what would be the parting bits of wisdom that you would want to offer if they are starting to look at leveraging their old data?
I think you have to go and really start looking at the technologies that are becoming more available every day out there, whether it's machine learning or now the AI that, you know, artificial intelligence is becoming more and more popular, but machine learning is now being applied in more and more cases and providing more and more benefits to companies with their existing data and even new data. So it's really, you know, make sure that you understand or learn what those are, because I once had not too long ago, I got certified in Data Vault methodology. It's a new way of doing your data, enterprise data warehousing and in the data lakes.
Of course.
But the instructor there, he quoted, and I can't say his name because he didn't, was anonymous, but he quoted that, you know, if you're not working with machine learning technologies in the next 5 years and you're in the data space, you're probably not going to make it. So it's going to be that pervasive and required to continue to survive in the IT and the data space. So
we have been speaking with Mark Balcanetti. He's the director of technical over at Talend. I want to thank you so very much for being with us, for sharing your overview of big data, of data management, of data lakes, and for telling us a little bit about Talend. If you could, please tell our audience where they can find you, where they can find your work, where they can find your blogs, and most definitely where they can find Talend.
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter at Mark Balk, and I have a fun series on craft beer and data that
and extreme cycling, I've heard.
Yeah, I like to mountain bike a lot, so do some crazy things, maybe Leadville next year. And you can find Talend at www.talend.com, and you can find all of our solutions and products out there.
You know, we have a couple of electric mountain bikes that we're testing here in the studio.
Oh, I don't. that electric? That's not actually fun.
Mark Balcanetti, thank you very much for being on This Week in Enterprise.
Thank you very much.
Folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 data lakes. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, of course, to our guest, Mark, and to my co-host, Mr. Brian Chi, who has braved the fires of Tartarus, or at least the fires of fiber, to be here on the show. Chibert, can you tell the folks where they can find you before you disappear for 6 weeks?
Well, I am ADVNETLAB at Twitter. I'm also Chibert at twit.tv. And please write to me. I'd love to see show suggestions. JJ, yes, your friend Noah is scheduled for the 22nd. Anyway, as a closing mark for Mark, data scientists in general aren't real good at, you know, a lot of the geophysicists and oceanographers I start working with have only just started learning how to spell big data. So my suggestion to you is look up the American Geophysical Union. It's a conference at Moscone Center in San Francisco in, I think, the new year. I would love to see Talon do a presentation there.
Okay.
Because I really and truly think there's an awful lot of scientists that if they can learn about the tool, learn the value, and be able to get enough knowledge so they can plan for it, if you can plan for the expense, you know, maybe a year or two ahead of time and put it into your grant proposals, education can afford high-end consulting, but they have to plan for it. And it's one of those things where you seed the market and then it's got a long tail.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
Indeed. Again, thanks, Chibert. It's always great to be able to do anything with you. And you have one more week, right? Because we have nothing next week because of the Thanksgiving in United States, the Thanksgiving holiday. But are you back for one episode after that before you go away?
Is this it?
Are we going to be Chibertless for 6 whole weeks now?
Yeah. Yeah, because December 1st, I'm on a plane.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, Chibert, I will see you when you get back. Am I going to see you at CES at all, or that's probably a bit too much travel?
No, not CES, unfortunately.
But we're going to do DEF CON Black Hat together, right?
I am planning on it, even if I have to pay for it myself and take vacation.
Oh, fantastic. Chibert, always a pleasure. And please give Kathy a big hug for me. And you two enjoy, because you truly do deserve a vacation.
And I'll give Kurt and Carol a hug for you.
Yes, please do. Please do. Also, thanks to you, to the people who watch or listen to this show. If it weren't for you, we wouldn't have This Week in Enterprise Tech. We want to make sure you can get all the enterprise goodness you can stand. Now, the best way to do that is to go to our show page at twit.tv/twiet, T-W-I-E-T. There you'll find all of our back episodes along with our show notes. So if there was a question you had about a story that we covered or a topic that we discussed, that's where you want to go. It also has contact information for our guests. So, for example, if you want to find out more about Mark and about Talend, you're going to want to go to twit.tv/twiet, T-W-I-E-T. Now, don't forget that as long as you're there, you might as well subscribe. This is the best way to support the show. Just go to that little drop-down menu and get the version of choice in your device of choice. You can get an audio version, a video version, or a high-definition video version. Again, twit.tv/twiet. Right? I use the right one this time? I keep using the wrong one. Also, if you want to see what I'm doing when I'm not here at the Twit TV studios, you can always follow me at my Twitter account at twitter.com/PadreSJ. There you'll see what I do when I'm out of the studio, or you get to see what happens when things explode in my lab. You know, it's kind of fun, and it might actually chronicle my death one day if something too big explodes. So, yeah, there's always that. Finally, thanks to everyone here in the studio who makes this show possible. That includes Lisa and Leo, who have allowed us to continue doing This Week in Enterprise Tech, for Alex and Jemmer B and Burke, who make sure all the cables and cameras are working properly, and of course to my TD, Kevin the Shark. Now, Kevin, as always, we have to ask you a question to offer you some redemption from the previous weeks of total fail. A little bit of wisdom that comes from the show. So this is it. Let's make it really, really simple. When you are comparing data lakes and data forests, which ranger is in charge?
Smokey the Bear.
I'm sorry, it's the Blue Ranger. It's always the Blue Ranger. Maybe you'll get it next week, Kevin. Thank you, but nice try. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballester, the Digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep quiet.